Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Zachary Lazar, whose new novel is Vengeance. Zachary Lazar is the author of Sway, Evening's Empire, The Story of My Father's Murder, and I Pity the Poor Immigrant. His new novel, just out, is titled Vengeance and is set in New Orleans and in Angola State Prison. Zach teaches English and creative writing at Tulane University. Zachary Lazar, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. It's great to be back.
Now, you've done a lot of work with students who are incarcerated, teaching them writing. Mm-hmm. Tell me about how you got into doing that.
I spent about a week, for the first time, a week at Angola prison as a journalist. And it was a very immersive kind of time because my friend Deborah Lester, the photographer, and I were there for a week, and we spent the night there. We ate our meals there. I had a lot of just open-ended time to speak to people who were incarcerated. And one of them I became pretty good friends with. I've been friends with him for 5 years now. And he's written a novel that I've found a publisher for. And he is a rather unique person, but there are others who are in the same camp, sort of. Creative people, artistic people who are incarcerated. And so I wanted to try to do some kind of creative writing class with prisoners. And the opportunity eventually came about because my friend Kathy Fontenot, who was a warden at Angola, is now the head warden at this place in Lafayette. And without Kathy, the project would be impossible, but because she's very open-minded, she's let it happen. And so we've done it for 3 semesters now.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how is that rewarding for you?
Well, honestly, I think it's probably more rewarding for the students than it is for me, because it's kind of very complicated and logistically complicated.
Of course.
It's a lot of work. But the students, so it's half Tulane students and half inmates. They're working together for the whole semester. They're doing the same reading and writing assignments. And so they get to know each other really well through all of that. Mm-hmm. And I get to know them too. I mean, but the merging of those two communities is what I think is one of the things that I think is the most important about it, and what most rewarding for me too.
So tell us a little bit about the work you were doing with Deborah Lester that inspired this novel. You were observing a passion play at Angola.
Yeah. It was just really fortuitous because I had just met Deborah at that point. We both do this work about crime. You know, this is my 5th book. Deborah's got a long career as a photographer.
Right.
We both have this shared history. We both had a parent who was murdered. What was more interesting, perhaps, is that both of those murders happened in the same city, Phoenix, Arizona. These were both contract killings. The same detective worked both of the cases for a while. Very strange coincidence. Many years later, we end up living in New Orleans, where neither of us is from. We live 2 blocks away from each other. And so Deborah, who had done a lot of work at Angola already, was going back to do this work about the passion play they were putting on. And that seemed like, you know, very obvious, ready-made thematic material, story of redemption in the wake of violence, biblical figures, inmates playing at biblical figures in a play, which, you know, all of that was true. I didn't know what I was going to see when I went there or what I was going to get out of that whole week-long experience. It had less to do with me and Deborah's story than I thought it would. It had to do with Louisiana.
Right, of course. Now, this is a novel that blurs so many lines between fact and fiction. It reads like a memoir in the first place.
Right.
You use real names of real people in many cases,
sometimes,
but not all, just sometimes. And you've created this character. It was, I think, a little bit you, you know,
the narrator.
The narrator, yeah. And this person who becomes the great subject of the narrator's observation, Kendrick King.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you talk a little bit about that as a formal, you know, challenge as a writer and the reasons why you chose this strategy.
Okay. Yeah, it's a great question. The book was me trying to kind of capture the experience of going to a prison for a week and hearing all of these stories and knowing that these stories were performances, even if they were true, and knowing that there was no way for me to know whether what I was hearing was the actual truth or not. That was part of it. And when you're put in prison, your life is reduced to a certain fiction, a level of fiction, by which I mean your identity is kind of taken away from you. Your past and whoever you were in its completeness is no longer available to you. You are the worst thing you ever did, and that's what you are, kind of, in terms of the way the system views you. That's a kind of fiction, I think. There was another strategy in this book, though, which was that I needed to be in the book, I thought. I was writing about incarcerated people, many of whom are people of color. I'm a white writer. I'm not even from Louisiana. I thought my subjectivity was, you know, was a part of the story. What I ended up having to do then was just making this much more of a postmodern kind of novel than otherwise it would have been. And once you start making those choices, everything else sort of has to follow. And there are other choices you don't foresee. But I wanted to tell a story about a guy in Angola in prison. And the character I developed is named Kendrick King. Kendrick is a kind of a composite of different people and also just a lot of fully imagined stuff from my part. He's kind of indicative to me of what I saw in general there.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the people I spoke to did not say that they, like Kendrick says, I'm innocent, I don't belong here.
Right, I thought that was so interesting.
There weren't many people that said that.
Yeah.
And the ones that did, they were haunting to me because what, you know, imagine if you were innocent and you were there. So that stuck in my head and I wanted to imagine a story in which the reader is put through a kind of maze where you think Kendrick is telling you the truth and then you think he's not telling you the truth. And then you think again, well, actually, maybe he is telling you the truth. And writing out the plot of this novel was very difficult for me because I wanted to create a kind of a complicated narrative of what had happened to put him in prison that you could interpret two ways. You could interpret it that he was involved in this crime that he's been committed for, or you could interpret it that actually, no, he wasn't involved in this crime that he was convicted for.
Well, did you find when you were actually in the prison as a writer, as a journalist, did you find that people approached you because they wanted to be written about?
I think that was a lot of it, for sure. You know, once it became obvious that I was this guy going around with a journalist pad and pen, there was a lot of interest in getting interviewed. I didn't have to seek people out. So here's another reason I wanted to include myself in the book, though, is because the fact that I had a murdered father meant that I had conversations with people that were much deeper than they would have been if I didn't have that bit of information to share with them.
Right.
And I felt like that circumstance of me being at the prison with that biographical fact was important for the story I wanted to tell, because what was amazing to me was how much people who were at the beginning complete strangers would share with me.
Mm-hmm.
And they would go really deep, you know, really fast. And so I felt like my father's murder was kind of a passkey into their world.
Well, I wonder if you'd read a little bit, because everybody wonders, you know, what is it like? What is it like to be in prison? I know one writer, a woman writer who visited Angola and couldn't take her sunglasses off. Kept her sunglasses on the whole time because it made her feel safer. And, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So everybody has a kind of reaction to that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you'd read a little bit about being there.
Sure, sure. What I'll read is a very preliminary part of the book where I'm just trying to describe a little bit of how mystifying it is when you first enter that space. And they're rehearsing for this play. It was dawning on me as I stood there watching all this that the men working on the still emerging sets with tape measures, levels, hammers, and saws were not hired carpenters but inmates. The man standing next to me in the Texas Longhorns cap with a Nikon camera was an inmate. He was a reporter for the prison magazine, he told me, covering the same story I was covering. A man who happens to be the Son of God is betrayed, convicted, and sentenced to death. On the third day, he rises from the grave to save the world with a message not of retribution but of mercy. As I said, I began to lose track of what was happening. Almost as soon as Deborah parked her truck, and this sensation didn't stop, I was alone and began to wander, talking to more and more people on the edges of the action, writing down what they said, although little of it registered clearly. When I wrote down the word murder, for example, it didn't register much more than if I were a nurse writing the word allergy in a medical chart. The reporter in the baseball cap was a murderer. He'd set his girlfriend's house on fire, then shot her to death. I couldn't get this past act to match up with his present. In the arena, he was just a middle-aged man, small, soft-spoken, with a slightly sunken-in, sunburned face. Like almost every other inmate at Angola, he was expected to die on the prison grounds. In Louisiana, a life sentence literally means life. There's almost no parole. The state also has the highest rate of incarceration of any place in the world. A life sentence comes with an exclamation mark and a question mark, one inmate told me. Wow! And then, when's this going to end? Imagine you're trapped in a barn, another inmate said. Now imagine that the barn is on fire. You will do anything you can to get out of that barn. You will do anything you have to get out of that barn. Murder, kidnapping, rape, drug addiction, poverty, abuse, all pointing to the terminus, life and prison. Deborah had told me to come without expectations, to not prepare, and it was true. I didn't need to prepare, or even ask any questions beyond the most basic ones, but I didn't know what a burden of information was there waiting for me. I interviewed more than 40 people over the course of that week, and what they told me filled up more than 90 pages of typewritten notes. After a while, I became an ear and an eye, nothing else. I found it impossible to go to the bathroom or even find a drink of water much of the time, because on my way to do either, I would be interrupted with another story, another tragedy, another life presented for my appraisal. Imagine you're trapped in a barn. Now imagine that the barn is on fire.
I swear, Zach, you read that passage, it's unforgettable.
Oh, thank you.
You know what I mean? That stayed with me.
Thank you.
For a whole day. I just couldn't get it out of my head. And some of the most lovely passages are passages you write that contrast just ordinary life with what the narrator has seen at Angola. Mm-hmm. And just the passages about life in New Orleans, about Mardi Gras or going out to dinner. Mm. Just the things that we take for granted. You know, those reminders that we should not take those things for granted.
Yeah. It's hard not to take them for granted. But yeah, I think that those passages, which came late in the composition of the book, were needed to anchor this thing in the complexity of the world that we live in, where people are in prison. I have good friends who are in prison, and yet they wouldn't want me not to enjoy the dinner party at the restaurant.
Of course.
You know? In fact, they enjoy hearing about it. I don't know what I have to say about those sections, except that, I do think a novel has to be celebratory in some sense. It was hard to find a way to do that in this book, honestly, but I think you had to do it.
I don't know. I could sort of imagine you going, oh, good. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm giving myself a night out just in writing this. You know?
Yeah, no, that's so true. And yet, on the other hand, I had this odd hesitancy to do it because I felt like I'm going to look like complacent or something. I'm just going on with my ordinary life.
Well, one of the most exquisitely crafted parts of this novel is the way that it is a kind of vision quest.
Hmm.
The sections are titled Glimpse, Gaze, Mirage, Blindness, Vision, Metaphors of Eyes, Home Movies, you know, what we see, and it's just incredible. And it was so interesting to me when you have a character draw on Leonardo da Vinci's ideas of the three kinds of people.
Yeah.
You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, well, so one of the things I was struck by when I was doing the interviews, and I went back to Angola many times after this first week, but I would be struck by the people would reference all kinds of things that you would not be expecting. Nobody ever referenced Leonardo da Vinci, but, you know, Machiavelli came up, I remember, and all kinds of stuff would come up. People's musical tastes would always surprise me. So I knew that it wasn't far-fetched to have Kendrick drop this quote from Leonardo da Vinci, but the quote, I found it somewhere. It was, there are three classes of people, those who see, those who see when they are shown, those who do not see. And I just thought that was so much about what this book is about. And even the reception of the book is going to bear this out, because there will be people who do not see it. I mean, why is he mixing fiction and nonfiction? What's the point of that? I think the point of that, to me, is pretty obvious. I don't know that it's obvious to everybody. I think I wanted to write a novel instead of just nonfiction because I also wanted to, get inside the point of view of Kendrick, at least for parts of this novel. That was the challenge. I'm a fiction writer. I want to know what it's like to be in other people's consciousnesses and their bodies. Without that, there wouldn't have been much reason for me to write the book.
And so it was freeing for you to have this mix. Ultimately.
Yeah. I mean, free within a straitjacket. It was a hard book. I mean, it was a lot of the decisions I made about how to write it had to do with, I don't know, political or ethical considerations sometimes. And that's not true for every book. I mean, it can be a little true for most books. But this book was really kind of in the foreground almost. And that's not the kind of writer I tend to be or want to be even. But this was a project that inserted itself into my life, and there was a choice, you know, either I can write about what I saw there or I could just cop out.
Well, the narrator of this book suffers so much. Mm-hmm. I mean, worries so much. There's a scene where the narrator suffers this temporary loss of vision that is terrifying, and is racked by doubt. And then at the end has this confrontation with a person where they discuss the work of repairing the world, that concept that is so important in Jewish thought, and the idea of vengeance. Mm-hmm. So I want you to talk a little bit about that, about why you chose vengeance as a title too.
As a title, yeah. It's a kind of an odd title because it's an ironic title. It's a critique of the idea of vengeance. It has to come, again, from a point of view of someone whose father was murdered. I think that the argument doesn't make sense without that part. That's what happened to my father. Many people who have had a parent or family member was murdered might actually believe in the idea of vengeance for obvious reasons. But I was never really that big of a fan of vengeance even before I went to Angola. But after having gone there, that impulse seems to me to have nothing to do with the crimes that put people in prison in the first place. I mean, it's not that it has nothing to do with it, but it can't assuage what happened. There's nothing that can be done to revoke what happened. The past, it's happened. You can't bring the dead back. The title just came late in the process, and the more I thought about it, the more it seemed like that's what has to be the title. A lot of people might have disagreed with that, but I hope that what the reader feels by the end of this book is, wow, it's called Vengeance. How messed up is that?
It's a very strong title. It really is.
Thanks.
So talk a bit about that idea of repairing the world.
That, this Hebrew phrase is tikkun olam, which I learned many, many years ago, just researching mystical traditions in Judaism. And the idea is that you have 11 emanations of God in these vessels, and the power of those emanations are so strong that the vessels can't contain them and they shatter. And the world that we live in is that shattered world. It's not the ideal world, it's the shattered world. And so our task on Earth, if we're to be ethical people, is to try to repair these shattered vessels. And the first thing you would need to do in order to repair them is to pay close attention to what's in front of you. And this has all kinds of interesting consequences in Judaism. I mean, in kind of Orthodox Judaism, you have all these strange rules about every aspect of life. You know, you must put your left shoe on before your right shoe, and you must, you know, tie the left shoe before you put the right shoe on. All these rules that I did not grow up in that kind of religious tradition, but I kind of, the vestiges of it, that always struck me as fussy and dogmatic. And why would anybody? Well, when I view it through this lens of repairing the world, paying close attention to the world, then I see, no, this is a way of making every single thing you do in your daily life a form of prayer.
Yes. And gathering up the shards, it's like such a wonderful metaphor for everything that happens in this book, you know, because it is so fragmented and fractured and through different visions all the time, so many different visions. A lot of writers say every book moves them along the path to the next book. How was it for you when you finished this book? What do you feel it did for you as a writer?
Well, when I first finished it, I was really exhausted and depleted, honestly. What it did for me, though, now that I've been finished with it for a while, is that this book opened up the territory for me as a writer of racism. That's something mm-hmm. I think
that's very clear
will inform my work going forward in a way that it didn't before. But having written this book, I found that I have much more to say about that subject, and I also have other modes of writing that I want to try. I want to loosen up a little bit. This book was, I used the word straitjacket before. I felt very constrained by this book because of that, you know, these close personal relationships I have with people who are in prison. And I felt a lot of responsibility, you know, to try to not get this wrong. And that's not like the usual kind of free, playful state that artists live in, I don't think. Mm-hmm. So I want that free, playful state that artists live in for my next book. I want it to be looser, and I actually want it to try to be funny.
I want you to have that free, playful state, too. But it's such an elegant book. It's like this, you know how some book you hold up and it's a light. And this book you hold up and it's like this really dark prism. Hmm. And it reflects that kind of dark light into so many corners of life. Hmm. It's kind of an amazing achievement that you've managed in a relatively short book that you can't put down when you're reading it, actually. So,
it's so good to hear.
It's not something that people should shy away from because of the subject matter. You know?
Yeah, I mean, that's such an interesting thing because, whatever else a book does, it has to be engaging. It has to be seductive in some way or another. And how do you do that when you're writing about something that is so difficult, grievous? And so I did work really hard to make it a page turner, you know, mm-hmm. while also incorporating all of these kind of unusual elements, like personal essay elements and fiction journalism all in the same in the same book, and it's a short book, but I think it's a pretty briskly paced book, I think.
And you're doing something very interesting for your book launch with The Graduates. Tell us a bit about that.
I'm so excited about that. So one of the women I met when I was doing the journalism part of this 5 years ago was in this passion play, and now she's out of prison, and she's part of this group called The Graduates. And The Graduates are all women who were formerly in prison, all were members of the drama club, and now they do this performance art to sort of try to move the needle on prison reform. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it just so happens the prologue of my book is me describing a narrator who basically is me going to that Angola prison to watch that passion play. And so the performance that we're going to do, I think, will be really cool. I'm going to read a condensed version of that, broken up with monologues from three women in The Graduates. And then we're all going to kind of crescendo at the end all together, and there's going to be singing. It's going to be really beautiful, I think.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
And a portion of the proceeds that night will go to the Innocence Project. Would you like to say a few words about that?
I would, yeah. I mean, this book is, I don't want to spoil it. Spoiler alert. But the Innocence Project and the work it does is obviously very thematically relevant to this book. And they are an organization that I just greatly admire. So I wanted to use this book in some way to give back to them. And so, yeah, I will, for every book sold at this event, I will make a matching donation to the Innocence Project of New Orleans.
That's very generous.
So buy the book even if you don't want to read it.
Exactly. Mm. Well, read the book. Come on,
Zach. Read the book too. Once you've bought it, you might as well read it. Right?
Yeah, I know. We want everyone to read this book. We've been talking with novelist and memoirist and teacher Zachary Lazar about his new book, Vengeance. You can meet him Thursday, February 22nd at Café Istanbul in New Orleans. He'll read from his book and appear with The Graduates, that performance group of women who were formerly incarcerated in the women's prison at St. Gabriel, and a portion of the proceeds will be donated to the Innocence Project. Zach, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. I really appreciate it.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life. George Saunders discusses his book Lincoln and the Bardo, Tuesday, February 20th at 7 at the New Orleans Advocate on St. Charles Avenue. This is a ticketed event with a fee. Tickets available at Garden District Bookshop. In celebration of Black History Month, the Louisiana Center for the Book in the State Library of Louisiana welcomes author and reigning Miss Louisiana Universal, Havila Malone, presenting her motivational seminar, Take the Leap, Turning Pain into Purpose. That's Wednesday, February 21st at noon in the State Library Seminar Center, 701 North 4th Street in Baton Rouge. Miss Malone is the co-author of The Amazing Adventures of Oliver Hill, 17 short stories based on the principles of success by Think and Grow Rich author Napoleon Hill. She's also the author of How to Become a Publicity Magnet in Any Market via TV, radio, and print. Clayton Delery signs out for Queer Blood, his book about the killing of Fernando Rios, Thursday, February 22nd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guest, Zachary Lazar, discusses and signs Vengeance, along with a performance by The Graduates, a group of women who were once members of the drama club at St. Gabriel's Prison, Thursday, February 22nd at 7 at Cafe Istanbul. Kendra Holly signs Keto Happy Hour, 50-plus low-carb craft cocktails to quench your thirst, Thursday, February 22nd at 7 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Christopher Shipman and Brad Evans read from and sign their long collaborative poem, Keats is Not the Problem. Thursday, February 22nd at 7 at the Dogfish Reading Series. That's at 2448 North Villery in New Orleans. Check out the New Orleans Writers Workshop offerings for the spring season. 9, 4, and 3-week sessions, as well as weekend offerings from wonderful New Orleans writers. Spring sessions start February 26th. To register, check out neworleanswriters.com. Thomas Bonner and Judith Bonner discuss and sign the new edition of Sherwood Anderson and Other Famous Creoles, February 27th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Friends of the Terrebonne Parish Public Library hold their 15th annual Jambalaya Writers Conference. That's March 3rd at the Main Library in Houma. Featured guests this year are horror writer R.L. Stein, Jocelyn Jackson, Melissa Marr, Louisiana poet laureate Jack Bedell, David Middleton, Maurice Carlos Ruffin, Katie Simpson Smith, Lady Hubbard, Bill Lofelm, Liz Talley, and many others. For ticket info, go to mytpl.org to register. The Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities has selected Leah Chase as its 2018 Humanist of the Year. The Queen of Creole Cuisine is the author of the Dickie Chase Cookbook, and Still I Cook, and Leah Chase, Listen, I Say Like This. She and other honorees will be recognized May 10th at the 2018 LEH Bright Lights Awards Dinner in New Orleans. For ticket info, go to leh.org. The Humanities Books Award recognizes two illuminating works of history as 2018 Books of the Year. Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White, by Michael Tisserand, and The Thibodeau Massacre, Racial Violence and the 1887 Sugarcane Labor Strike, by John DeSantis. The Light Up for Literacy Award, presented in partnership with the Louisiana Center for the Book in the State Library of Louisiana and the Library of Congress, goes to Sisters of the Holy Family. Music and culture journalist Ben Sandmel will receive a Lifetime Achievement Award, and a posthumous lifetime contribution to the Humanities Award will be presented to the late Mary Lou Christovich, preservationist and author. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.